comment, Tommy.
Well, I woke up this morning.
Yes, yes.
And I looked outdoors.
Outside, you mean?
I could tell my milk cow. I could tell by the way she looked.
Tell me more.
If you see my milk cow, ooh, drive her on home.
Home delivery of groceries wasn't invented by Instacart or even by Amazon. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell has for us this morning the story of one local company quietly marking 100 years of front porch service with a low-key celebration and a lot of new customers. Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System. Good morning.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, it was last year sometime before the pandemic that I first noticed that the Smith Brothers Farms truck in my neighborhood had founded in 1920 painted on the side of it. Made a mental note to get in touch and learn the history of this local company. And so a few days ago, I spoke with Dusty Highland. He's CEO of Smith Brothers Farms. His last name isn't Smith, but he is the great-grandson of the founder, Ben Smith, one of the two original brothers. The other was Roy. Now, Smith Brothers has, in fact, been around since 1920. Their drivers delivered dairy products and other groceries from a fleet of 60 trucks based in Kent. They fan out from Olympia to Marysville. Now, they don't have their own cows anymore, but the operation did all begin in West Seattle with just a single set of udders.
My great-grandfather, Ben, the founder, his neighbor was moving, so he bought the cow from him because he was getting milk from his neighbor. And started milking the cow in West. He lived in West Seattle at the time, and had extra milk, so he would bottle it in glass bottles and kind of peddle it around his neighborhood. I think he probably made a couple bucks that summer just doing that for fun. But it, you know, more and more people started asking him for milk, and he ended up buying another cow. And before he knew it, he was back in those days. He said, "As my second job, I was making $100 for the summer, and I thought I might be onto something here."
And he was, and the company grew, and so did the herd of cows. By the late 1920s, the operation had become too large for the original farm in West Seattle.
They had grown the number of cows to like 30 at that point, and needed more space for them. So they actually, they literally herded, walked the cows from West Seattle down the Des Moines Freeway down to Kent Valley.
Wow, a cattle drive from West Seattle to Kent.
It was a cattle drive from West Seattle to Kent.
I wish there were photographs of that. They eventually settled on a big farm south of Kent along the West Valley Highway. It was all there, room for the cows to graze, milking parlors, and a bottling plant. Ben's sons, Howard and Dan, became involved. And they got a little diversified. They actually built a little airport there on the farm, a private air park with a runway and everything. Added other stuff to the business. And Dan Smith, one of Ben's sons, took over the company in the 50s. If you look at all the old newspaper ads from the 40s and 50s, those were really the glory years for Smith Brothers and a few dozen other dairies in the Puget Sound area. But the rise of supermarkets in the 60s and 70s and changes in consumer habits around shopping, plus the increase in real estate value of what had been these huge rural farm areas, meant that most of those other dairies eventually went away. One of the last other ones to leave was Vitamilk, which had a plant near Green Lake until about 2003. But Smith Brothers kept going, though they did start to make changes. Founder Ben Smith passed away in 1978. In the 90s, his granddaughter, Alexis, took over the company. In the 2000s, they actually sold all their cows, and they moved to new headquarters in Kent and brought the delivery drivers in-house as employees rather than independent contractors. Now, with these moves, Smith Brothers outlasted that first round of internet grocery competition. Anybody remember Home Grocer and Webvan? So they added things like bread and coffee and produce. And while the pandemic meant they scaled back their centennial celebration plans, it actually has done wonders for their business. In the past 6 months, they've grown from 54,000 to 67,000 customers. Wow. And orders from their existing customers have increased, too, as people have not wanted to go shopping. Now, great-grandson Dusty Highland took over the company about 8 years ago. He says that the growth this year has been intense, and he admits it wasn't always creamy smooth.
There were definitely some operational growing pains over the last 6 months. But, you know, the thing that we talked about internally was we had made enough advancements in technology and our team here and the quality of people on our team now that we're able to handle it. And 3 years ago, I think it would have broke us. I think we would have had to turn customers away.
Yeah, and as far as the centennial goes, they might wait until next year to do some of what they'd originally planned, but there are special centennial milk containers. They have a Lego Smith Brothers milk truck, which sounds pretty cool, and they're doing some special charitable stuff. I did have to ask Dusty Highland about one other thing that's disappeared along with those suburban dairy farms, that distinctive dairy farm aroma. He said that when he was younger, he actually was a little embarrassed by the whole thing.
I grew up in the 80s, and I was cool and I didn't want to be associated with the dairy farm. And so I was always kind of embarrassed by it and didn't appreciate it. And now when I go visit some of the farms that we buy our milk from and talk to the farmers, there's a nostalgia to the smell that, you know, I actually appreciate now and am now embarrassed that I was ashamed of it as a kid.
And, you remember when there were dairy delivery trucks on the roads all over the place. It wasn't that long ago, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was a kid, we lived outside New York City, but it was we were right next to a corn farm, and before the big developments went in, and it was the Walker Gordon Milk Company, and the milk came in bottles with metal caps and a metal band around them, and there was always cream on the top.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It wasn't homogenized, and I still have. I still have a fondness for fresh cream for some reason.
Which and you're out there in your knee pants and your newsboy cap waiting for the milk truck to come by. Probably.
That's right. Also, the wires that attach those caps were made of something that if you connected a current to them, they would glow. And so as I became an electronics nerd, I collected those wires so I could set fire to things. Don't try that at home.
And Felix, if you're looking nostalgic, just drive Highway 2 for a while. You'll get that aroma in a couple of spots depending on the wind.
That's right.
Yeah, but people in the suburbs right on the edge of the city used to get that aroma every day, Chris.
Right now, Monroe is a suburb.
I'm pretty sure you can buy one of those spray can scent things that recreates it in your home if you really need to.
Anyway, happy 100th birthday to Smith Brothers Farms, yes. And here's to another 100 years of milk delivered right to your door.
Yes, indeed. Felix Bunnell brought to us by the King County Library System. All his features are at mynorthwest.com. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Amy Coney Barrett, I'm starting to call her ACB now because there's too many syllables, faced the Senate Judiciary Committee. And one of the headlines in the Washington Post was, Barrett declines to call landmark abortion decision super precedent. And the question is, should we be afraid of that? Let's consult with someone who follows the Supreme Court, and that would be Professor Scott Lemieux, who's a poli-sci professor at the University of Washington. I guess I should ask you first, in general, did you see anything about her testimony that struck you as particularly concerning or not in the spirit of the Supreme Court's mission?
I was a little disturbed when she said that she would not recuse herself if there was a case involving the presidential election. There was also an exchange with Senator Klobuchar in which Senator Klobuchar asked her if it was violated federal law to engage in voter intimidation, which President Trump has suggested on Twitter a couple of times as tried to encourage. Mm-hmm. And she essentially declined to answer even after Senator Klobuchar read the statute that shows that it's a federal offense to engage in voter intimidation. I don't know how, you know, exactly what that implies, but, you know, it's a little disturbing that even given just a very narrow factual question, she wasn't even willing to go that far. And I think for people who are worried about what might happen if the elections in November get thrust into the federal courts, you know, I'd have to say that was a little worrisome.
Well, did you read that as an indication she would simply ignore federal law?
You know, I think that would probably be going a little too far. I guess the kindest construction would be that she's just very determined not to, you know, really give, you know, answer almost anything and give away information. But, you know, I think that the fact that she's not willing to even just acknowledge it's illegal to intimidate voters while take it seriously, if not ignore federal law, it certainly suggests that she might be inclined to interpret those statutes very narrowly if it's intimidation, particularly in major urban areas.
Well, this is a familiar ballet that seems to play out during every court hearing involving a Supreme Court justice. They never want to talk about how they might rule in a particular case, and I think they err on the side of just saying less rather than more. Is there a problem with that? Do you think the standard should be changed so that Supreme Court justices do telegraph exactly how they would rule in a particular case during the nomination process?
You know, it's a tricky question, but, you know, it does concern me a little bit. And, you know, obviously this goes back to when Ronald Reagan nominated Robert Bork. He had an extensive history of writing both as a scholar and as a public intellectual. And he had written, you know, essays arguing the Civil Rights Act shouldn't have been passed and giving a very narrow read of the First Amendment and that Roe should be overruled. And, you know, as a result of those writings, he was voted down by a bipartisan majority. So since then, with a few exceptions, justices have just declined to, you know, more or less say anything about their views. Famously, Justice Thomas said that he had never thought or discuss Roe versus Wade before, even though it was decided when he was a student at Yale Law, and he had mentioned it in previous writings. I guess what bothers me in this context, and on the one hand, I understand judges not wanting to say how they will rule in a future case, but on the other hand, there's this weird two-step where, you know, Republicans place an extremely high priority on judicial appointments, taking a fair amount of political risk by trying to get Judge Barrett confirmed at this late date. But as soon as the nomination process begins, Republicans just sort of deny that this nominee could possibly have, you know, the views that almost all Republicans have on constitutional matters. So several times senators have said, well, you know, how possibly could Judge Barrett rule to strike down the Affordable Care Act? She has seven children, several of whom have pre-existing conditions. Ben Sasse said that, but, you know, Ben Sasse literally voted against, to partially repeal the Affordable Care Act. And the Trump administration is currently supporting the lawsuit to get it struck down in its entirety. And there's really no way of making a justice talk, and this isn't going to cost her the nomination. But, you know, it does disturb me a little bit that there's a certain dishonesty about what Republicans are trying to accomplish. I think that it's better if the public knows this before an election and they have the right to try to get certain constitutional views represented on the Supreme Court. But I think that the public should know what they are. And I think this idea that if Republican senators genuinely had no idea about how she would rule, Merrick Garland would be on the court right now. So I think we all know that they expect her to rule in certain ways in major cases. But it, just as a practical matter, there's just no way to force a nominee to answer questions. So I don't have a solution to it, but I do think it's a little problematic.
Well, that is exactly why Merrick Garland's out in the court right now, because each party assumes that the nominee will parrot the party line. But there's also a history of nominees surprising the presidents or their successors who appointed them. I mean, that happens from that's the whole purpose of the court, isn't it? That you can appoint somebody who you think will rule a certain way, but there's absolutely no way to guarantee it, and that's why they have lifetime appointments.
You know, the Supreme Court nomination process has worked well for a remarkably long time. But one reason for that is that although there's always been ideological divisions on the court, this is the first time in which the ideological divisions map perfectly onto partisan divisions.
Professor Scott Lemieux teaches political science at the University of Washington. Professor, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Got a COVID update. Don't worry, it's not all bad. There has been an uptick in coronavirus cases in some counties, but at the same time, other counties can move to the next phase. The report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Just as several large counties had started the process of bringing some younger kids or special need kids back to school, a fresh uptick in coronavirus cases sparks new concern.
For the past 3 weeks, since the 21st of September, transmission and cases have been increasing in King County and regionally, as well as in many states across the country. Last week, we had over 1,000 cases reported in King County, and we're having over 140 cases reported each day over the past week. This is more than twice what we saw in late September.
And King County Public Health Officer Dr. Jeff Duchin says this is not the result of more testing.
More people are being tested, and that's a very good thing. Last week, we did about 45,000 PCR tests in King County, and that's the highest number since the outbreak began. Testing is up throughout the community, and we're continuing to add sites in South King County, Renton, Auburn, Tukwila, and now Federal Way. However, along with the increase in testing, the countywide positivity rate, although still relatively low, has increased from approximately 2% in late September to about 2.5% recently. And this is consistent with our interpretation that the increase in cases reflects increased transmission, not just more testing.
Overall, he says the two-week incident rate is about 88 cases per 100,000 residents. That's up from 50 just a couple of weeks ago. It's a similar story in Snohomish County.
Yesterday's published two-week case count was nearly 72 per 100,000 as of October 10th. Our staff are inundated with reports of 50 to 70 new cases each day.
The County Health District, Sean Fredrickson.
And given this new case rate and how close it is to the 75 per 100,000 threshold for high risk in the Department of Health decision tree for schools, Dr. Spitters did have guidance that was shared with the schools yesterday. He's asked that all schools hold where they're currently at. They don't need to move backwards if they've started to bring special needs students in K through 3 grades back. But they shouldn't bring any additional students in at this time.
As for whether that increase is about an increase in testing?
The increase in daily cases is a reflection of an increase in the positivity rate of the number of cases. not the number of tests that are being done themselves. Ideally, what we'd like to see as we continue to do more testing is actually see that positivity rate go down, which is a good signal to us that we are seeing decreased transmission of COVID throughout our communities. While we're seeing this increased number of positive cases and this increased positivity rate, it gives us an indication that we're seeing increased transmission of COVID through our community.
And Fredrickson says there's a new outbreak causing concern.
We're aware of a growing number of cases involving the Tulalip Boys and Girls Club. At this time, we know of at least 8 confirmed cases. We encourage anyone who may be concerned about possible exposure or was a close contact to seek testing. A close contact should remain at home for the full 14 days after their last possible exposure.
At the same time, the Health District Board Chair Stephanie Wright says they've got concerns about their ability to keep paying for their pandemic response.
Right now, the Snohomish Health District is currently expending about $700,000 to $750,000 per month on the response. However, the emergency funding to support these temporary positions and the response efforts is set to expire in December. This means we would have to eliminate most, if not all, of the temporary positions come January, unless the CARES Act funding is extended for another year. Loss of these positions and funding would severely diminish our capacity to continue responding at the same level. Without the capacity to effectively track and investigate cases, to support testing efforts, and to work with our partners around the region, our communities, our businesses, schools, and children will pay the price.
So?
I'm calling on all of you, asking you to please reach out to your U.S. senators, your representatives, to urge support of extending these critical CARES Act dollars.
Back in King County, Duchin warns.
Last estimate for the effective reproductive number was 1.6, which also indicates that our outbreak is growing. And it will continue to grow until we can push that number down below 1.
As far as schools,
I understand that COVID fatigue is real and the steps we need to take are hard. But the trends we're seeing today should be a wake-up call for everyone. The longer we wait, the more difficult it gets to change the trajectory of an increasing outbreak. And if we let it get away from us now, we may be in for a very dark time over the coming months. The potential for a significantly larger outbreak than we've yet seen is real, but not inevitable.
State Health Officer Dr. Kathy Lofi says the trend of increasing cases is in many parts of the state.
Increases we're seeing are within our most populous counties, so within the Puget Sound and Clark County and Spokane County. Those seem to be the counties that are starting to see an uptick in cases.
Meantime, a handful of counties have improved dramatically, allowing them to advance a phase.
We're moving forward in 5 counties in our phases. These phases currently are in Safe Starts Modified Phase 1, also known as Phase 1.5. And today, these 5 counties are moving forward fully to Phase 2. This applies to Yakima, Benton, Franklin, Douglas, and Chelan counties. And I have to say, it's a mark of progress for these counties. Local leaders in these counties have worked hard to knock down this virus, and they have done so. They're not out of the woods yet, we know that. But these counties and their people have made tremendous progress. For example, Yakima County in early June was averaging 753 cases per 100,000 residents, and they're currently averaging 93. So to go from 753 to 93 is enormous progress.
Governor Inslee said the move is about leveling the playing field and getting everybody up to Phase 2, and does not mean that he'll be resuming advancing phases.
And Hannah Scott joins us live. So I've been reading articles about how these average R numbers are not that useful, that what you have to do is look for these super spreader events and track everybody who is at those. And any indication that we're going to approach it from that direction at all?
I haven't heard anyone mention that specifically. I know what the in Snohomish County, they made clear that what they were seeing the uptick come from was the result of kind of these large gatherings, right? People who are hanging out with people in larger groups from outside of their home, maybe closer friends or even relatives that don't live within their home. That seems to be what they were attributing it to, but no mention of the super spreader kind of investigation. So something I'll definitely ask about.
Yeah, because the argument is that you have these events, you have certain groups of families that have these. I think the latest one, and this is nation, I don't know that it was here, was a Sweet 16 party, right, where it spread to a whole bunch of people because they were acting irresponsibly. But then you penalize everybody for that, right, and then shut down everything else when you have a few people who are just acting crazy.
Right. And you can't always do that. And really, collectively, what I heard yesterday from the various county health officers that spoke yesterday was overwhelming concern about those specific kind of things. Again, hanging out with people from outside your home who you're close to and you feel like maybe you don't need a mask. There's a lot of that COVID fatigue that I heard mentioned yesterday. Yeah. And as we are approaching kind of the holiday periods of time, and we've had maybe kind of less of the increases over the summer, people are being less careful with what they do, not masking up, not maintaining that social distancing. And there's really a legitimate concern that this uptick that we've seen over the last couple of weeks, which is fairly significant, could grow out of control. So I think they're really just trying to sound the warning bells and say, look, we get it. We know that you guys are tired of doing all this. We are too. Even Jeff Duchin said, he's like, I want my pre-pandemic life back too. But we really have to stick to it and stay masked up and be careful who we go around outside of our own homes.
There is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness is brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. For many veterans, coming home and adjusting to life outside of active duty can be difficult. When 33-year-old Navy veteran Maverick Kendrick returned, he found himself with no home.
My first night that I spent on the street, I was in Uptown Manhattan, the A train. I stayed on the A train until I fell asleep. And then when I woke up, I would wander around. I would go get some food, apply for jobs, see what resources were out there to help me get out of my situation.
He told the Today Show he was homeless for years, often sleeping on trains.
It was hard. It was humbling. It was embarrassing. I was ashamed. I would sleep with my face covered like most homeless people on the train do.
Maverick finally got the help he needed when he connected with the Wounded Warrior Project, but also an organization called House a Vet, which gave him a mortgage-free home. Nancy Bistra is with the Wounded Warrior Project. She says Maverick has come a long way, and his resilience is inspiring.
Maverick, he really is a spark of life, and I absolutely love watching him grow. And I love, even when he's down, I love how he picks himself up.
He moved into his new home this past April.
The whole time I was going through the process, I've been turned down a bunch of times from different organizations. So when they told me that I was receiving a mortgage-free home, I felt like Ashton Kutcher was going to come out and say I was punked. It was all a joke.
And the nonprofits also helped him land a steady job at a local tractor supply store. He says one day he's going to pay it forward and do something to help other veterans, too. For now, though, he has a message for them.
I think it's important for veterans to understand that though we might not feel as needed or essential, that we are needed, we are essential, and we are veterans.
If you know someone in need or a veteran, you can visit the Wounded Warrior Project or houseavet.net. Maybe the most confusing part of our country is how veterans are not revered and held to the highest and taken. I mean, this has been generations and decades of hearing these stories. How is there not a system in place to take care of them from the moment they exit until they are successful in a job and home? It's beyond me.
There should be.
Yeah.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott with his recommendations for how we can celebrate the holiday season while maintaining a safe distance from those we love.
I never said that all of it was going to be safe, Dave. I just was going to give my recommendations. So okay, I'm going to try my best.
Well, what about Halloween? We should start with Halloween.
Okay. Well, as for me, I'm not the person that dresses up all the time.
No.
However, I am the person that has the big dogs, the life-size candy bars. I got the goods. So I put, I want to be known in the neighborhood as, yo, you remember that dude right there at that house? The reason why that's important. I'm that house. The reason why it's important to me, because I go back to my childhood, and I'm sure you go back to your childhood. And, yeah, there was some places in the neighborhood that had their houses all decked out. That's cool. But you know who me and my partners talk about years later?
Who?
The folks with the best candy.
The best candy.
Yeah. Not the ones
who
gave
out apples or
candy.
Carrots.
Not the bit of honey.
Or those booklets talking about Halloween is the devil's tool. I had one of those neighbors, too.
Really?
Well, every year we go back hoping they would have candy, but every year we get that booklet about the devil's holiday.
Yeah, yeah. And then apples. Like, come on, really? Excuse me. Are you really going to give me an apple? Like that is not cool. Don't give me an apple. And then in Chicago, I don't know if that was going on out here, but in Chicago there was reports of people putting, like, bad stuff in candy. Right? Like, yeah.
Has anybody ever found a razor in their candy?
Thank you, Colleen.
I've been working in news.
Thank you.
Well, Dave, you've been working in news longer than I have. Do you recall reporting on a story about a razor in candy?
Well, we had the story, but it never actually happened.
Here's the thing, guys. Remember, my parents were law enforcement. So my dad, as a cop, he would make me put my candy on the floor and inspect it.
Oh, of course.
Like, come on. Sure. No, there's no confirmed cases of this.
We even had those foreboding stories about, now make sure you don't mix up your candy with your edibles and hand kids marijuana, as if somebody is going to give away their expensive edibles. I just, to me, those stories, like, you know, the health department has issued a warning. How ridiculous do you think we are?
Well, I only give out the commercially wrapped candy anyway. It's not like you put a bunch of Neckos in a baggie and hand them out.
Neckos in a baggie.
Hey, Dave.
Yes.
Let's set the record straight right now, man. Do you eat candy corn, bruh?
No. Okay. I do not like candy corn.
Okay,
no.
Cool. All right. For some reason, you kind of took me as someone who did.
I limit myself to the Au Chocolat chocolates or like Theo chocolate, any kind of really classy, got to be 70% or more.
What's your guilty pleasure candy, Dave?
Guilty pleasure?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll just give you an example from last night. I needed a dessert because I didn't have any prepared. So I went to the Chobani yogurt, the plain yogurt.
Stop.
And I got the Chobani.
I'm going to stop you right there.
I got the jar of walnuts. Jar of semi-sweet chocolate chips.
No.
Oh, my God.
That's not a good
thing. That's not a cheat,
Dave.
I'm talking like Caramello, where you fold the entire candy bar into your mouth and chew it until it melts.
No,
like,
would,
guilty
no.
pleasure candy bar.
Tell me right now, Dave, that in your freezer, you got some Reese's Peanut Butter Cup on deck. Right now.
In the freezer? No, I do not. I don't. I have some Neckos. I do have some cherry cough drops.
Oh, finally. Finally, something I've heard of. Everything else, I'm like, I've never heard of that. Never, Dave. Listen, man, it can't be a guilty pleasure if Colleen and I have never heard of the candy that you're discussing of.
Well, I'll keep that in mind next time I go candy shopping.
What kind of cereal do you have, Dave?
What kind of cereal? Crispix, and Snoqualmie Falls oatmeal.
Oh my God.
I always tell this story. But when I asked Dave once, "What's your favorite drink?" he said root beer.
Well. It's really good. There's a lot of sugar in it. Now, that's
I don't even know why I ask anymore.
You look at the sugar content in that root beer, and that sucker is hard stuff. So you're going to hand out candy with your selfie stick this year, or what?
No. What I'm going to do, because when I was doing my delivery stuff, doing DoorDash and stuff, I noticed there's people out there that put, like, nice stuff. Like, hey, if you're a delivery driver or you're dropping off anything for us,
nice.
Go ahead, take something. And they would put something on. They put a basket on their porch with, like, candy and water bottles, and you can take whatever you want. So I think that's what I'm going to do this year. Like, I'm just going to leave it all out.
Self-serve, huh?
Self-serve. You know what I mean? That'll last
about 15 minutes.
I'm going to say, hey, Scout's honor.
Scout's honor. All right. G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock this morning. Thanks, G.
See you guys.
Washington's Lieutenant Governor Cyrus Habib, who is not running for another term, has already left the state to start his training as a Jesuit priest. In the meantime, the two people vying to replace him faced off for a debate, and Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has the highlights.
The race for lieutenant governor pits former congressman and well-known lawmaker Denny Hecht against longtime state lawmaker and majority state Senate floor leader Marco Lias. The pair asked about their priorities should they take the seat during a debate hosted by the League of Women Voters. From Senator Leas.
My first priority is COVID-19 recovery and response. We've got to ensure that we are helping families and small businesses who are struggling in this moment. And we have to build our economy back better than it was before the crisis. Not just an economy that works for the millionaires and the billionaires and the big corporation, an economy that works for every single Washingtonian.
And Congressman Heck.
The upcoming legislative session, everybody's priority ought to be dealing with the COVID pandemic and continuing to allow, as Governor Inslee has, science and data drive our solutions and the economic recovery, which the state must participate in, doing it in a way that more broadly shares prosperity, and of course, taking care of the budget shortfall. It's imperative that we protect the vulnerable and that we protect those institutions that will help our state grow. And that would include, of course, higher education as we attempt to skill up the 1 in 4 people who have lost their jobs and aren't getting them back.
Leas put the pressure on Heck and his colleagues in the other Washington.
Well, I agree that COVID-19 recovery is front and center. And I would just challenge Congressman Heck and all of our members of Congress to get their act in gear and get us relief and assistance right now. We've seen, because of disagreements between the House Speaker and the White House, another bailout package, another assistance package fade away. We need help on the ground. We've got families and businesses that are struggling in this moment. We can't wait till January. We need Congress to act right now, asking him and all of our delegation to get that done.
Asked about the state's regressive tax system, Heck laid out his priorities.
In this upcoming legislative session, when new revenues will be needed, in all likelihood, but not certain yet, we shouldn't enact anything that doesn't make our system less regressive. There are any number of revenue sources that would help do that, and they've been talked about amply in the public. The trick, I think, here is not to lock in on one and say it must be this one, but to lock in on the standard. We're not going there unless our system is rendered less regressive by whatever combination of revenue sources we would enact.
And the two are not terribly far apart.
First, we've got to raise taxes on the wealthiest Washingtonians who aren't contributing their fair share. And there's a number of measures to accomplish that, and I support those. But we've also got to talk about how we reduce the tax burden on our lowest income Washingtonians. It's why I supported increasing the senior property tax exemption threshold so that our seniors who are paying property taxes aren't taxed out of their homes. And we hadn't adjusted those income thresholds in years. Now, tens of thousands more seniors qualify for that exemption. We've also got to pass the working families tax credit to help ensure that those struggling to join the middle class aren't getting taxed out of that opportunity as they move forward.
Heck said he would support a state income tax and a capital gains tax, with Leas saying his support would be for an income tax on high income earners. Asked what he would do to help end systemic racial inequities, Congressman Heck had this to offer.
So I think what we ought to begin with is justice in policing. I'm a proud co-sponsor of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act that passed the House of Representatives earlier. And I think that's a good place to start, but I don't think that we should end there, because we also have discrimination and a history of racism as it relates to access to jobs and education and healthcare, and especially as it relates to housing. We have structural racism in this country. Housing is a good place to start, making sure there's no discrimination, making sure there's an adequate supply of affordable market-based housing that Black families can have access to, because it's the single largest tool of building net worth in this country is home equity.
From Senator Leas.
I think we've absolutely got to address the racism that exists in our policing structures. The fact that Black Washingtonians have to live broadcast their police stops in order to feel safe while interacting with law enforcement is inhumane, and it shouldn't be happening in Washington in 2020. We've got to make some serious reforms there. And that means more transparency and more accountability by our law enforcement. We've also got to tackle policies like mass incarceration. Here in Washington, we have 4 times as many people in our prisons per capita as our neighbors to the north in British Columbia. And they're just as safe as we are. We are wasting a generation of Black and brown lives in our prisons, and we are wasting money on that.
On homelessness?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that the state government can do is to invest more in the Housing Trust Fund. Right now, we invest millions of dollars. We should be investing over $1 billion to make the critical investments we need. We also have to do more as state government to create this supportive environment, supportive housing, and a behavioral health system that work for people, so we don't push people into homelessness because of lack of access to health care and to behavioral health. The other piece that's critically important is remembering that we've got eviction policies and rent policies in our state that are also pushing people at the margins into housing instability.
And Congressman Heck agreed about investing in the Housing Trust Fund, adding,
we also need to incentivize localities or municipalities to adopt zoning approaches that will enable for increased construction and density. I am the prime sponsor of the bill to do just that, that passed the U.S. House earlier this year, because we're not building enough units. And if we don't allow for denser housing, we're going to get more sprawl and all the environmental deficiencies associated with that.
Leas was asked where he'd come up with that $1 billion to invest in housing.
Yeah, it's about prioritization, and it's also about going to the people with the need. The people under the Constitution have the authority to approve a bond measure for important investments like affordable housing. The bidding climate is low right now. We can get more for our money.
Both candidates said they supported universal health care and a public option. Though Leas stressed his support for a public option would be as an incremental step, and that he'd prefer to have something not tied to jobs. But Congressman Heck pointed out,
I do think I need to point out that in the 5 years he's been in the Washington State Senate, Senator Leas has failed in every regard to co-sponsor the bill, which he now says he supports during the campaign. It has been introduced. He's not signed on to it, nor as the Senate floor leader has he taken any action to bring it out for a vote.
Overall, the two were fairly close on the majority of the issues.
All right, Radio's Hannah Scott.
You can ring my bell. Ring the bell.
And this is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And thanks to the uncertainty of these uncertain times, turkey farmers are in a dither, as Rachel Bell has discovered.
How's my impression?
That's pathetic.
Do yours. Oh, yours is like a little bit more hyper than mine.
Well, the turkey knows where it's headed.
That's true. Oh, that's sad. Well, you know, it's sad, but we're all going to eat it anyway. Most of us anyway. So there was an article in the New York Times all about what is going to happen on Thanksgiving this year. And, you know, every year it just suddenly becomes the holiday season. And I think that some people are looking forward to it and some people are dreading it, because a lot of people are not going to be going home like they normally do to see their family. Or even if you're, you know, in the same area, people are not gathering like they used to. So the question is this just going to ruin turkey farmers this year? So there are two sides on this. Number one, there's a lot of predictions that people are going to want a smaller bird, or they're just going to want parts like the turkey breast or the turkey wings. And of course, that people are going to gather in smaller groups this year because of the CDC travel recommendations and people not wanting to eat with people outside their household. So that's number one. But the problem is there are these smaller turkeys and they're called poults. I've never heard of this before, but it's hard to just pivot at the last minute. They have to decide in March or April what kind of turkeys they're going to grow, how many they're going to grow. So they're afraid that there's not going to be enough of the little ones. And the greatest fear of all turkey farmers,
yes,
people might get a chicken instead.
No.
I prefer a chicken, to be honest.
I don't, for Thanksgiving, really. I have chicken all the time. The whole idea of Thanksgiving is a special feast, not the same thing, just more of it.
That's true. But I don't eat a whole chicken that much either. I mean, I never do the chicken on Thanksgiving, but every time I have turkey, I wish it was a chicken. I feel like it's always a little too dry and you always have so much left over.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to figure out what we can do here to help the turkey farmers, because the last thing we need is another category of business that falls apart and goes bankrupt. So it seems to me if they're worried about smaller gatherings, meaning that people are not going to buy as many large turkeys, why don't we just go ahead and buy large turkeys anyway and freeze the leftovers? There's the same number of people, so eventually we're going to eat we potentially could eat the exact same number of turkeys, but maybe we just prepare it in a different way.
That is exactly what the big companies are focusing on, like Butterball, because, you know, every year they have their turkey hotline where people can call and ask all these questions. So, number one, they're going to really focus on that hotline because they predict that there's going to be a lot of young people who don't go home like they normally do, who are going to be cooking their bird for the very first time. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a lot of sales. And then, like you said, people have been so much more into cooking since the quarantine happened and really using what they have, trying to go to the store less, that they do hope/predict that people will be more excited about the leftovers and a little bit more tricky with them and try to turn them into something else, where normally the day after, you know, you might just go out for Chinese food.
Yeah. Well, the other thing they could do is, what one of the things is, you're used to buying the giant frozen turkey, right? And then it takes a week to thaw or whatever it does, and then you eat the whole thing. Instead, why don't they saw those suckers in half and sell half frozen turkeys, right? Because you'll have twice as many gatherings, each one of which will have half as much turkey.
I think that's a great idea because I don't know if a lot of people know this, but when you go to the grocery store, if you want to buy a half a cabbage, you just ask them and they saw them in half all the time. They've always said yes to me.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. So if you just want like a half, because it takes forever to eat a cabbage, let's be honest, well, no matter how many people are in your home. But yeah, I think that'd be like a little bit grisly, but also you could just lay it flat and have that leg sticking up on the platter.
By the way, the secret to getting through a cabbage is to buy one of those smoothie makers and just
a blender?
Eat the cat. Yeah, a blender. Well, Ma, it's got to be more than that, though. The blender doesn't work. You have to get these high speed things with the super because you're blending up carrots and cabbage and kale and that kind of stuff. Just put the cabbage in that thing and add some yogurt to it, and you can eat a whole cabbage lickety split.
I love how this has turned into a recipe show because I have one of those high power blenders.
See?
And now tomorrow I'm going to have a cabbage smoothie.
That's right.
Yum.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, my little turkey.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.